So we are starting our Easter series, and for us, Easter is a proclamation that the impossible has been made possible. We are saying particularly that a death has happened, and it's death to death itself. And we have the audacity to face the tyrant of every human being and say to it, we are immune of you, and we will be unaffected by the things that you do. Easter is the telling of the only lasting story. It's the retelling of the truest of all stories. Now, Nietzsche got it right. God is dead. And we tell that story that God did die. And yet, because God's love is unceasing, and because his sovereignty knows no end, because his glory outshines all light, he undid death. Like taking ice out into the hot August sun and watching it dissolve and melt, it's just gone. Death is gone. Easter is the declaration of Jesus and by Jesus that resurrection is true. And because it's true, fear is gone in your life. The moment that your eyes close in the twinkling of this lifetime, they will simultaneously open in the presence of the Father, and there will be no more brokenness. That's our declaration. This is an opportunity to come and say, resurrection is everything for everyone. If you drink the cup of Jesus's life, and if you drink it deeply, not just that momentary camp come down and sing kumbaya by a fire once, but this, I'm going to follow Jesus with all of my life, you will find that resurrection is the elixir of life. It is the long lost fountain of youth. Easter is the time that we declare the magnum opus of God. It's the crowning jewel of his accomplishment. And it's so important for you and critical for me. God slowed things down. And he did it for like 1,500 years as he wrote his words in the Bible. And the Bible's before you and in your laps and on your phone are the actual words of God. The story of the Father, and it's for you and it's for me. And he wrote this story in many different cultures, through many different voices, so that no one would feel like they're excluded. So that no one would feel like they're misunderstood. Every angle possible the story of God has been covered. It's like picking up a premise and slightly turning it and seeing different hues of the light, seeing different angles of the light. If you look at the Easter story in one way, you'll learn it's about law. It deals with the law. It deals with penal substitution, that there was punishment. I deserved it, but it was substituted on Jesus and he took it. It deals with law. Then if you turn it just a little bit more and you look at the story from a different perspective, you realize it's not just about law, but it's also about inheritance. That I had no inheritance and Jesus had everything and he picked up his everything and put it into my nothing. And now I have everything because I have Jesus. It's about inheritance. If you turn this prism just one more time, you'll learn it's about the greatest of all things. Faith is great. Hope seems greater than faith, but with faith, hope, and love, love is the greatest of these. And the story of Easter is about God's love for you and for me. This is the story, and this multi-perspective story means it's not just for women or men. It's not just for children. It's not just for the elderly. It's not for the smart or those intellectually challenged. It's for everyone, right? This story of Easter, it's our primary message as followers of Christ. Christmas, lots of time, gets all of the hype. It gets all of the attention. We start celebrating it in February and go all the way through December. But I tell you this, the first birth of Jesus is nothing compared to the second birth on the other side of death that Jesus had. Many times the cross becomes the primary symbol of Christianity. And historically, it's endlessly important. But I tell you that the cross is foolishness if there's no resurrection. Christianity and Easter and Jesus is about resurrection. And so we invite you. We invite you over the next 4 weeks, come and walk with us. And I think the series is going to be a little bit surprising for you. There's no way to get to life on the other side of death without going through death. And so we're going to spend some time over the next few weeks dealing with life and the futility of it and what death really is. One author said this, don't too quickly rush past Good Friday. Good Friday actually is the worst day of all days. It's the day that poor, deluded, confused humanity looked at the only righteous one, the only good one, and said, you did wrong, you should die, and God took it. And we want to look at God taking our own death, not to put guilt on you or me, not to point fingers or make you feel full of shame. We want to walk through what we really did. So looking into the depth of how broken we are, Good Friday can fade into Saturday, which can rise into Sunday, and all of the joy of Sunday can backfill all of the weight of the brokenness of what we've done. So I invite you, walk through death with us just a little bit in the next few weeks so we arrive at the day of joy. Right? Here's our plan for the next few weeks. Today we're going to look at the futility of this life. Next week we're going to talk about the truth about death. We're going to speak directly, just because you're human, does that mean that you absolutely will go to heaven? You should join us for that. Then April the 9th, Palm Sunday, we'll talk about you have to die to live. And then finally, April 16th, the death to death. All four of these weeks will come from 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So let's jump into the futility of life. And what I want to do is for 1 minute, tell you what the futility of life is not, so we can spend the 25 remaining minutes of our time talking about what the futility of life is. When we say the futility of life, we are not saying that your life is useless or mine. We are not saying that it should be degraded or belittled or what you do is of no value. Actually, historic Christianity says precisely the opposite, that you are image bearers of God. As women, you're created in the image of God. As men, you're created in the image of God. And that God wove you together in your mother's womb. And so from the weaving together of God of you to whenever you die, every moment in between is of immense value to God. You bear his image. And so the way that you work is valuable to God. He gave you gifts and abilities and talents, and you should use them for your good and for the society's good and for the glory of God. The way that you deal with other people is of immense value to God. Love people and show them Jesus. And listen, the way that you suffer and the way that you go through moments of grief, the way that you experience depression and pain, it matters to God as well. There's no futility to that. God is not collecting data on you for some weird experiment. I'm so thankful in John chapter 11, when Jesus' friends lost a close loved one, that Jesus wept with them. And so there is a futility to life, but that futility does not mean on any level that your life is invaluable or worthless. It's quite the opposite, okay? Here's what I do mean by the futility of life. And let me give you an example, a story in my own life to kind of explain it. And we'll spend a lot of time fleshing it out. We are painting our house this week. And if you've ever painted a house, it's a silly expense. It's stupid expensive to have to paint a house. I think paint companies probably make a gallon of paint for $1.12, and they sell it for $35 a gallon. And I painted our house a little over 2 years ago, and I painted it with a product that on the label it says lifetime warranty. And you know it's not really going to be a lifetime warranty. It's going to be 6 or 7 or 8 years at the most, but you really need 7 or 8 years from one paint job. So about a year and a half into this new paint job, it started to peel. Like huge sections started to peel off. And after a year of watching that, I kind of got frustrated. So I went to the company who painted our house and I said, "You have to do something about this." To which they said, "Oh, this isn't our fault. This is the manufacturer of the paint's fault." So I go to the paint store and I say, "This is happening." And they say, "Okay, we understand. You're going to have to call the national hotline." So I get the national hotline number and I call the national hotline. And they say, "You're going to have to talk to the manager in the local store." So I go back to the manager of the local store and he says, "You're going to have to talk to the regional director." So I get the regional director and he says, "Ha, ha, ha, you're going to have to call the national hotline." Right? So I get everybody on one conference call and I say, "I'm the nicest guy in all the world. I like you guys a whole lot. But if we don't figure this out, I'm going to have to escalate the situation." To which the guy says, "What does escalate mean?" And I say, "Well, I have a national hotline for you," right? Because that's all I could really come up with in the moment. That's the futility of life. It's just round and round and round and round. And you know it all too often. The moment you do yard work, you turn around 3 days later and it's worse than it was when you first did yard work. The moment that you get your inbox email down to zero, what you didn't know is everybody else was trying to get their inbox down to zero. And they immediately shoot back thanks 50 times. And your inbox is full again. The futility of life is standing in line for the movies. And you get in the short line because that's smarter. But the long line is moving faster than the short line. The people that were behind you are now in front of you. So you switch lines only to find out now the credit card machine is broken for this line. That's the futility of life. Or you just did laundry. and you need your jeans to make it for 2 weeks. The only time in 2 weeks that you eat ketchup is today, and you spill it all over your pants. You're thinking to yourself, who wears jeans for 2 weeks? And you're looking to see if my jeans are dirty as you sit in jeans that are 3 weeks old, right? That's just kind of the futility of life. And if this is the futility of life, I would say, do whatever you can to eke out any pleasure at all, because soon you will die. Right? Does God have anything to say about this? If you have a Bible, turn to the New Testament. Turn to 1 Corinthians 15. The passage for today is just one verse. It's verse 32. It's up on the screen in front of you. It says this. What do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So Paul says this, what gain is there in this life if the dead aren't raised? I went to Ephesus and I fought beasts. Why did I fight beasts if there's nothing more than what's happening in this world? Now, most scholars don't think that Paul actually is talking about fighting beasts. Later in the New Testament, he gives this long section of all the persecution that he went through, and that wasn't one of them. Most think that he's talking about the difficulties of ministry. And I want you to hear this. If you're loving anybody, if you're telling anybody about Jesus, if you're trying to demonstrate the greatness of the gospel, you too are in ministry. And there are going to be moments that you feel like you're fighting beasts. Ministry is not just speaking up front like this. It's not just counseling people or praying for people. There's a whole horde of stuff that ministry is. Now, some really hard things. And over the last few years, I've been a little bit hesitant to speak about some of the hardships of ministry, because I never want you to feel like we don't have bandwidth to walk with you in your suffering. So I just need you to take me at face value. If you're suffering, we have all the bandwidth in the world to walk with you. But I think it's really important for you to hear the difficulties of ministry, because you're going through this as well. I have sat with a man who tried to commit suicide and his kids found him. And in that moment, I found darkness that I had never discovered before. I have sat with countless men and women who have been verbally abused, physically abused, and sexually abused, and I've wept with them. And I've left those meetings much more sad than I was before. And you don't recover from that. I've sat with families who have lost their children, adult children even, young children in their 20s. And I've grieved with them, but I've also grieved at my absolute ignorance and incapacity to comfort them or to love them. I've sat with couples doing marriage counseling for years, begging them to like fight for this thing and work for this thing, and God can redeem anything, only to watch them in anger separate, leave the church, and the relationship with me too is just gone. I've in personal need reached out and needed help, and it's only been met with the need of others and criticism that it couldn't perfectly happen in the right way at the right time. And it just goes on and on. And if you have ever loved anybody, if you have ever prayed for anybody, if you've ever bled for anybody, you're right here in this exact same place. Paul's talking about this, the difficulty of ministry. And so we ask, and you will ask this someday if you haven't, is this worth it? Is there anything that would make this worth it? And Paul says precisely, what gain is there for me in that? Now you might push back and say, well, Paul shouldn't be looking for any gain. He should just do this because this is the right thing to do. And I don't disagree with you on any level at all, but I would say this to you. Not being able to ask what the gain is contrary to your heart and to the heart of all humans. Humans have this insatiable thirst for more, to gain. Every single one of us does. And it's interesting because I don't think anything else does this. Dolphins don't do this. Dolphins don't find little coins that you leave on the beach and keep them down in the bottom of the ocean somewhere. They don't do that. Ducks don't do this. Dogs don't do this. Now, this is my dog, and that's all he wants. His life is perfect right there. He's not collecting stuff. He's not saving money up. He's not hoping for a new doghouse. None of that. He's just in heaven right there. Only humans have an insatiable thirst for more. I learned this at an early age. When I was in high school, I spent a summer in Albania, and communism had just fallen. And I watched things happen in a small Albanian town that I'd never seen anywhere else. Unemployment was about 75%. Poverty was rampant. They had very little to eat. Primarily, they were eating cucumbers and tomatoes. But every single night at 6:30 in the afternoon, the city just emptied out onto the streets. Businesses were empty. Every apartment, those concrete Soviet block apartments were emptied out. And the street was packed full of people. They played games. They huddled up. They told stories. They walked. They laughed. And as you had conversation with Albanians, you could see that they were pretty happy and they enjoyed each other. But if you asked them, what is it that you want from life? They would tell you immediately, hands down, the American dream. We want American cars. We want American hamburgers. Multiple people said this to me. We want the teeth that Americans have. And they would smile and all their teeth was gone. So you're like, well, of course, that's a good starting place. You need teeth, right? They wanted more. Right. 2 years later, I saw an article in Time magazine about the same tiny town in Albania that I was in. And on every apartment from those Soviet buildings, now, when the Western markets had opened up, had satellite dishes on every single apartment. Every single one. And remember, they were poverty stricken. Somehow they had saved up for a satellite dish, and the sun was setting in the background. Nobody was on the street. Not a single person. Even though their hearts were happy and full when I was there in the midst of poverty, they wanted more and more and more. And so they crammed in and they looked for these things. The human heart always wants more. It always asks, what gain is there for me? It comes in a little bit different ways all through life, but you ask this question. When does it come? How do I get it? From where does it originate? Is it going to be good enough for me? And it's just absolutely a massive question in your life. It's a massive question on the level of, do you love me? Am I loved? Do I belong? Is there anything that can satisfy me? These questions that aren't just asked once and answered once, but asked repeatedly through our lives. And since you're asking it religiously, you're seeking answers for it religiously. I want to push this just a little bit. So listen, here's how big of a question I think this is. I think, is there gain for me? Is the second most critical question that a human asks. The second most critical question. And here's why. Every human, everywhere, longs for more. And you will, consciously or subconsciously, fill the longing of your heart. Absolutely you will. And so it becomes the primary force in your life. I have this insatiable thirst, and I'm going to put something in there, and you spend the days of your life looking to fill your heart. This is not something that's happened new. Capitalism didn't make the human heart this way. If you think that, you need to read history, or probably because we never read, watch Netflix, a documentary, and you'll find out that it's always been this way in every single phase of life for us. Our heart wants more. You want more power, you want more pleasure, you want more success, you want more money, or, and this is tricky, you want more simplicity, you want more quiet, you want more ease from a lack of stuff, but it's still more, it's just different. Your heart is longing for things. And so what happens is we want and we acquire. And when we acquire what we wanted, it lasts for just a little while, and then the feeling is gone. Our heart is still empty, and so that thirst revs back up and pushes us on. And even though we know if we were to sit down and convince ourselves, we still think, if only my body was a little bit more in shape, if only I was more beautiful, if only I was smarter, if only I was richer, if only I was nicer, if only I was liked more, then finally I would be satisfied. So we immediately go to the next thing. I really do wish there was a Netflix documentary on this. Like that one from the guy who ate McDonald's for 30 days in a row and died or almost died. You could just watch it right there and like, oh yeah, that's a bad idea. Don't eat McDonald's for 30 days. Like you needed a documentary on that one. I wish there was a documentary that we could watch like 30 years in 5 minutes. And then it occurred to me, actually, there is a documentary on this. It's in the Old Testament. His name is Solomon, and he tries this. And let me tell you this, Solomon was the king of Israel, and he had much better and much cooler stuff than you have. You have an iPhone 7, he had a palace. That's different. His life was cooler and better than your life. And so he sets himself off to try everything to see if anything would fill this insatiable thirst. Look what he says in Ecclesiastes 2. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. That's us. That's our culture. We think entertainment will please us. We think that travel is pleasurable. We think food is pleasurable. Craft beer is pleasurable. Sex is pleasurable. If you watch TV, just for a moment, there's going to be a promise that this thing will solve the longing of your life. It won't be phrased in that way, but this is the pleasure that your life is missing. So Solomon set out and he tried almost everything. Let me give you just a few of the things that he tried. It's absolutely perplexing how many things he was able to try to see if he could solve the problem of his heart. He tried pleasure. And for pleasure, he tried laughter in Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verse 2. He tried wine, which we don't drink as much of here, but craft beer, he tried that. He had singers, it says, in Ecclesiastes 2, 8. He had the whole cast of Hamilton come into his house when he was bored. And they performed for him, and he's like, that was good. And then he wanted more. So he tried concubines, the delight of the children of man, which is broken and sinful. But we think sometimes our culture is not like their culture. They were kind of pure and Bible thumpers back then. And our culture is erotic. But he had 1,000 women. And it didn't solve his heart. For accomplishments, he tries this. I made great works in Ecclesiastes 2:4. He built houses. He planted vineyards, right? He didn't go to Lowe's and buy some pansies and plant them. He planted vineyards and gardens and parks, and he made for himself pools from which to water forests of growing trees that later he cuts down and makes cities, right? So you walk into your house and you're bored and you think, my kitchen is terrible. I'm going to renovate my kitchen. You renovate your kitchen and you're happy for a few moments. And then you think, well, the den doesn't really match the kitchen. The kitchen's nice. The den is old. So you renovate the den. And then you have to go to the bathroom. So you go to the bathroom. You're like, this bathroom's terrible. So you renovate the bathroom and then the bedrooms. And then you come back downstairs and you're like, well, now the kitchen's old. And you have to start all over again. That's what he's doing. But he's not just doing it in his house. He's building cities. Right? That's not renovating a house. Here's what he tried for money. I had great possessions of herds. Right? You have a dog, just one, and you gave it away because it was too much. Right? This is possessing herds of dogs or packs or whatever they're called. And flocks, more than anyone who was before me. Right? And that's what we buy into. If I could get farther ahead than anybody else, then my accomplishment will make me look good. But he was far ahead of anybody else. And then I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. Right? There's one passage in the Old Testament that says that gold and silver was so common in the kingdom of Solomon that they were like rocks on the ground, as common as a rock was. If you need money in Solomon's kingdom, just pick up a rock and it's made of gold. That's how wealthy he was. And he says this in 2, 9 and 10, just in case you don't think, well, he didn't really try or accomplish everything. He says, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desire, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure at all. For my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all of my toil. He's surrounded with people. He has all of the pleasure of the heart of men and women. He has accomplishments that make everybody else's accomplishments look like failures. And he is flush with money to the point that he was the richest person of his day. And so what's he say? What's his conclusion? Did this work? Well, he states it a couple of ways, and we'll end with that. Here's his conclusion in Ecclesiastes 1, 2, and 3. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Vanity here means vapor, like you're chasing a vapor. Everything he did, all of the things that I just read to you for him was like a child chasing a bubble. You catch the bubble and it breaks. It's vanity. Here's what it's like. And I'm not against this at all, but think about the madness that we do as humans. We want our kids to get scholarships to school. And so at a very early age, like 2, we start teaching them to play sports. And at age 4, we go into traveling sports teams, hoping that our kids will be wildly athletic and they'll get a scholarship to school, because we're not sure that we'll be able to pay for college, and a scholarship is the way to go. And so you take your kids to watch the girls' baseball games, and you go to D.C., you'd have to pay for travel, pay for food. They win, to your surprise, so you have to stay a second night and a third night. And you do this for an 8-year-old and an 8th grader all the way through high school. And then you realize that 1 out of about 2,500 athletes make it to college. And your kid, even though they were great and you've invested all of this, they didn't get a scholarship. So one statistician tried to figure out how much money a family spent on just one kid doing traveling sports. And it was $70,000. College is like $68,000, and you just spent $70,000. That's vanity. Everything that you did was wasted, and you have nothing to show for it. He goes on and he says, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. Right? Doesn't that make sense? It's profoundly simple. You've listened to music, and never once after you listened to music did you say, well, my ears are full now. I don't ever need to listen to music again. You never once had your eyes satisfied with seeing things. You never traveled and saw the Alps and said, I never need to see again. You never looked at a naked woman or porn and said to yourself, my lust is satisfied. It's just irony. You never drank wine and were satisfied. Yeah. You drink it because you like the taste, but you really like the slight buzz that it gives you. You don't want to get drunk because you feel bad when you're drunk, but you like the buzz. And then 2 glasses don't do it, so you have to go to 3. And then 3 glasses don't do it, and so you have to go to 4. And you face this reality, vanity of vanities. You're either going to become an alcoholic, or wine just doesn't do what it used to do, and it didn't really last the way it should last anymore at all. And so after a 30-year documentary on Netflix, Solomon says this. And it's the last verse we'll read and close with a quote. It says this: what gain is the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. And then verse 14, I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it nor taken away from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. Solomon just said, we need more. We have this insatiable thirst for gain because we've lost something. And our hearts are looking for the thing that we've lost. And you'll fill your heart with anything trying to find the thing that you lost. And the thing that you lost is eternity. You were created for eternity for Jesus. And when we rejected God in our sin, we lost that. And everything that we do is looking for that thing that we lost. It's why C.S. Lewis says, if I find myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. The guy who tried everything says, the only thing that will satisfy your life is eternity. If you're a doubter or a seeker, you're welcome in this place. This is family for you. And you can have a good life without Jesus. It's called common grace. But I promise you this. There's not going to be anything satisfying in your life for the rest of eternity other than eternity itself. You are hardwired to pursue Jesus and know Jesus. And this day, you can take the cup of Jesus and drink deeply and find him and be satisfied finally. And then if you're a follower of Jesus, this is such a large question, you don't just ask it once. You're asking constantly, does anything satisfy? And you remember that moment that you walked up front and you believed or you accepted and it was a spiritual high. But it's not just once that you ask this question. You're asking it constantly. And so the moment that you begin to realize you've asked this question and you've put money in the center of it, you've put sex in the center of it, you've put accomplishment in the center of it, you've been so broken you've put that in the center of it, is the moment that you can finally be free. Could it just be that your insatiable thirst for sex, that your uncontrolled desire for alcohol, that you're needing to be accepted, is really that you've looked at Jesus and then turned away. And today's the day you come back and find that. Every human heart thirsts insatiably. And the only thing that can solve that thirst is Jesus. That's the futility of life until you find him. Follow Jesus. Let's pray. God, we ask that you would meet us in this place and that we'd feel deeply this insatiable thirst for Jesus, that we would know that no thing can satisfy that or solve that other than him, and that we would stop looking for it in places that we know it can't be found, that we would agree with Solomon. We tried everything under the sun and nothing satisfied our hearts. And then we realized that our hearts were created for eternity and Jesus is he, and we would follow Jesus. We love you and pray these things in your name. Amen.